Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Play ball! It's 30 with Murdy with your host, Sweeney Murdy.
Welcome back, everyone. Hope you're all coping and surviving and following the strategies to flatten the curve. Stay home, wash your hands, all the things we need to do to stay healthy and get past the peak of this coronavirus pandemic and eventually get ourselves back to a normal way of life. Part of the coping strategies for sports fans like us who are missing March Madness, the start of baseball, the playoff push and basketball and hockey, all that, well, we've been watching old games on YouTube or the various networks. And one of the things I've enjoyed is watching sports movies. Not much changes for me in that regard. I've always loved watching and rewatching my favorite sports movies. Now is a chance, though, for everyone to rediscover them in the absence of real sports, or perhaps find some new ones to enjoy. Last Saturday night, I watched Secretariat with my family and saw that for the first time. Really enjoyed that movie, starring Diane Lane as Penny Tweedy, the owner of the Great Secretariat. Nice work also by Kevin Connolly of Entourage fame. He plays William Knack, the legendary Sports Illustrated writer who wrote the book Secretariat. That movie was produced by Mark Chardy, who was a guest on my last episode of 30 with Murdy. Chardy, a former big league pitcher with the Milwaukee Brewers, has spent the last 20 years as a movie producer in Hollywood making great sports movies like The Rookie, Miracle, Million Dollar Arm, and Invincible, in addition to Secretariat. And here's a funny story. After texting Chardy the link to the podcast we did, after it posted, I sent along a note with it and said, hey, thanks for doing it. And he wrote, yeah, I did his podcast last week. Ha ha. I was a little confused. I wrote, you mean mine? Yes, thanks again. And he replied, OMG, I thought this was from D.B. Sweeney. Sorry for the confusion. Well, D.B. Sweeney, if you don't know, is a terrific actor, and he's been in some of the great rewatchable sports movies that I've been talking about. And so with the help of Mark Chardy's goofy text, I asked him to reach out to D.B. D.B. reached out to me, and here we are for the latest episode of 30 with Murdy. You know D.B. Sweeney as Shoeless Joe Jackson in Eight Men Out, and as Doug Dorsey, the hockey player turned figure skater in The Cutting Edge opposite Maura Kelly. His latest project is called Two Dumb Mix. It's a short film that Sweeney wrote and produced, and it co-stars Rudy, Sean Astin. They are already getting some film festival buzz and hopefully working towards a series of short films that star Sweeney and Astin as a pair of not-too-bright guys in some really funny situations. You can watch the premiere, the pilot, this coming Tuesday, April 1st. It's streaming on Facebook Live at Two Dumb Mix. That's D-U-M-M-I-C-K-S. Don't be offended. They're two guys named Mickey. It's at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Tuesday, April 1st. Sweeney and Astin will take part in a Q&A right after that. This past weekend, I had a chance to chat with my sort of namesake, D.B. Sweeney, about his New York roots, his love of sports and movies, and the stories behind his more memorable roles, including Shoeless Joe Jackson. Here is my conversation with D.B. Sweeney. First thing I want to ask you, DB, is as we're sitting around here trying to recreate sports, a lot of us are talking about watching sports movies and, you know, the ones that make us feel good. What are some of your favorites to watch besides the ones that you're in?
Well, I think the greatest sports movie of all time, I'd say there's three. Slapshot, which I watched again last week. I love that movie. And then there's Rocky and Hoosiers. Those are, I think, my three favorites, and I've watched them all over the last couple weeks. So I'm digging a little deeper now. I think we're going to do Field of Dreams later today.
Yeah.
There are a lot of them.
Yeah, and it's kind of a good way to recreate or just kind of channel our sports fandom into something that kind of brings us some of that same joy, isn't it?
It is, you know, and I think it's great. The storytelling that seems to work in those movies is you know, kind of traditional and not, I don't want to say predictable, because if a movie's predictable, then it's not, you know, going to be as entertaining if there's some twists and turns. But those movies have a certain template, I think, that is pleasing to us in the sense that it's relaxing and reassuring.
And you grew up a sports fan, so, I mean, this is kind of natural for you to kind of go back and reach back to some of these and enjoy some sports movies.
Yeah, it's been great. I mean, I my kids are home more than they would be. You know, they're have a senior in high school and a sophomore, and normally they'd either be at school or they'd be with their friends. So, I mean, I'm looking at the bright side here with this quarantine, but it's nice to have them around so much, and I've gotten them to sit through a couple of these movies, too.
What are their favorites now that you've kind of introduced them to some?
Well, my daughter's still all about Harry Potter. And I mean, not because she's the right age for it anymore, but just because of the nostalgia of it, I think.
Yeah.
And my son is pretty much, he's pretty strict. It's either James Bond or a space movie.
Wow.
Which is kind of random, but that's what he likes.
All right. So before we start getting to some of your career, I want to know how a kid who grew up on Long Island and was a teenager when Thurman Munson and Reggie Jackson, everybody was doing their thing, how did he become a Red Sox fan?
I first really became aware of baseball in 1967, which obviously puts an expiration date on me, but I was 6 years old, and the Red Sox obviously were making their magical run, and Carl Yastrzemski was a name you heard everywhere, and he was from Long Island, so it just caught my imagination. Wow, there's a guy from a town, you know, a couple towns over who's playing in the big leagues, and that's awesome. So I followed that, and it just stuck, you know, the way I guess everybody has their first moment. You know, people who have a team out of their geographic area, I think a lot of times it's due to the fact that some team was successful, you know, that they heard about in the media and started to follow them. So that was my story. And then as I was in high school, I was a sophomore playing baseball, and the town Yastrzemski's from Bridgehampton, and there was a bar there called Billy's Triple Crown. And the rumor was, if you go in there and you say that you're a Red Sox fan, the guy who owned the place would buy you a beer, even if you weren't 18. So it was true. The place was called Billy's Triple Crown, and it was Carl Yastrzemski was a pitcher in high school, I guess, and this was his catcher. And this guy had the whole place was a shrine to Carl Yastrzemski. It was pretty cool. And so I went there with my buddies who were sophomores in high school, and this guy's giving us beers, and he gave us a couple more of them. Of course, my Yankee fan friends were all like, yeah, we're Red Sox fans. And so after about two or three beers, this guy started to talk. He got really bitter, and he was talking about how I made that guy, and I should be on the Red Sox with him. And it got a little weird, but it was still a great memory.
Did you get a lot of grief from your friends who were all Yankees fans in the area?
I mean, until the Bloody Sock and Curt Schilling, it was all pretty much suffering and abuse. So you never really got taken seriously as a Red Sox fan. You were just sort of like redheaded stepchild, and, you know, they could just heckle you. So there was never any kind of real rivalry because the Red Sox never won.
Yeah, and so I guess you've been having the last laugh for the last 15, 16 years here.
It's been pretty good. You know, I mean, my brother is a staunch Yankee fan, season ticket holder to this day. He still lives in New York, obviously. And, so I get to give it to him a little bit. But the truth is, the Red Sox had, I was never a big Manny Ramirez fan. Like, I obviously admire his skill. But
yeah,
there were, during that era of the Pedro Martinez and Manny Ramirez, I thought, you know, I was rooting for Don Zimmer in that fight with Pedro Martinez, you know, and it was hard for me to root against Paul O'Neill and Mariano Rivera and Derek Jeter and all the great Yankees of that era. So I was kind of conflicted. I wasn't rooting for the Yankees, but I wasn't hating on them as hard as I normally did.
Yeah, and I guess you live in Chicago now, and you found a new love with the Cubs thanks to your friend John Cusack, huh?
Yeah, you know, I go along to Wrigley because I love Wrigley, but really my heart's on the South Side. You know, ever since Eight Men Out, the White Sox have been so good to me, and they sort of like treat me like, you know, kind of a member of the extended family. Kenny Williams, the president, now he was a general manager for many years. He's a good friend of mine. And so I go down there, and, you know, for the White Sox fans, I'm Shoeless Joe. So I love the Cubs, too. You know, I mean, both of those atmospheres, I think, are as good as some of the best atmospheres in baseball, especially Wrigley. I mean, with the Cubs winning now, obviously, it's very festive and fun. But the South Side, you got real hardcore baseball fans. It's pretty fun to go there.
That must be pretty neat to be a guy who, you know, grew up as a sports fan. You make one movie, you know, over 30 years ago, dealing with it, you know, not the brightest spot in that team's history, yet they still embrace you and treat you like gold there, huh?
It is pretty funny. And I got, last summer I got invited up to the owner's box, and I had met Jerry Reinsdorf many years ago, and I knew that you know, the anniversary of it was last year was 2019, obviously, right. And that was the 100th anniversary. And I said to Kenny, I said, "Hey, Jerry, maybe Jerry wants to do some kind of screening of the movie because for a charity, you know, for the Southside kids, you know, we could raise some money or something." And Kenny kind of set me up. He goes, "Go ask him." And I pitched him, and Reinsdorf said, "We don't celebrate that around here." So I thought, okay, that's the end of that.
Yeah. Well, I guess you had a little more luck with Chicago. Is that reading that you're basically considered a good luck charm to John Cusack?
Yeah, you know, I started that run in 2016. I started going with him, and you know, he's a really passionate Cubs fan, obviously, and and there was a bunch of other friends too that were Chris Kelios and Bonnie Hunt and Joe Mantegna. There's a bunch of people that are friends of mine. They're from here. That was like a once in a lifetime. Well, for so many people, it's a once in a lifetime. And I was sort of more of an observer. You know, I wasn't rooting against the Cubs, but I was, you know, along for the ride. So Cusack started bringing me to games because he had like a little, like a mini skybox. And, you know, he liked to watch the games by himself, which is sort of a story unto itself. Why would you get a skybox? He gets a skybox, he doesn't have to talk to anybody. And then, so he always had extra tickets. And he started noticing that when I'd come by, he'd just leave me a ticket. I'd come by, every time I came by, they won. So when they got to the playoffs, he started calling me and saying, you got to come. So it was pretty fun.
So I want to get back to your baseball career, because before you were Shoeless Joe and Eight Men Out, you actually played ball, wanted to play ball, and it wasn't just high school, college. You played overseas.
I did. That was sort of my bad career management. probably in the hottest period of my career in the early 90s, I did a movie in Portland, Oregon, and I guess I should go back a little bit. When I did Eight Men Out, I should go back even a little bit more. I played a little bit in college at Tulane University. I was an outfielder, right-hand hitting, not that big, not great speed. So I was kind of a tweener, like a good hitting for average, but I couldn't hit home runs. I couldn't steal bases. So it's, you know, not really what anybody would call a blue chipper or anything like that. But I could play a little bit. And then I got hurt and I became an actor. And when Eight Men Out came along, I thought, well, Shoeless Joe Jackson, he's a lefty. Nobody's ever done a baseball movie where it looks like a baseball movie. And at that time, you know, Bull Durham hadn't come out yet. I thought Costner was unbelievable on Bull Durham. But we filmed at the same time. And so I thought, here's my chance to, you know, to really make my mark. So I spent 2 months with the Kenosha Twins in the Midwest League, learning to hit left-handed and also trying to soak up what baseball might have been like in 1919, as opposed to, you know, even in the 80s, players are already staying in first-class hotels and making a lot of money and flying on planes. And, you know, so I thought riding the buses of A-ball would be closer to big league baseball in 1919. So I had a great summer, made friends with a bunch of people. 5 years later, I'm filming this movie in Portland, and the Portland AAA team was called the Portland Beavers. And five of the guys from the A-ball team in 1988 had been promoted to AAA, including my roommate, Terry Jorgensen. Hmm. So they said, come on down and, you know, take some BP. Because every game I was with the Twins, I took BP before every game. I was in uniform. They wouldn't let me play because the Twins controlled, you know, the lineup. So because they pay all the salaries. So the big league club, you know, doesn't let anybody that the A-ball manager wants to put in the game play. It's right. Just up to the big club. So I never got to play. But anyway, 5 years later, I go down and take BP, and I'd always hit lefty during my BP in A-ball. So this time I hit righty, and I just had one of those crazy BPs, and I hit a bunch of home runs, which I never did. And the pitching coach for the Portland Beavers said, "Hey, what are you doing after you finish this movie you're working on?" I said, "I don't know, probably do another movie." And he said, "Why don't you come to Australia and play, I need an outfielder, come play baseball in Australia." Hmm. And I did it. So,
how'd that go?
Well, it was a great experience. It was unbelievable, you know, life experience. But I come back. My agent couldn't understand it because I literally was offered more money during that period of 4 months when I was in Australia than any other time in my life. My agent didn't know how to explain to people. He's following his dream. He's playing baseball. He's in Australia. It's great. Instead, she told everybody in L.A. that I was in rehab. So I came back like I'm in rehab in Australia. I couldn't believe that was her version of what was better than playing baseball. So I come back, and I'm like, I had the time of my life. I'm telling everybody this is the greatest thing that ever happened to me. And I go into a meeting with the cast director, and the cast director leans in, and I'd met the guy before, and he goes, "Hey, how you doing, DB? Are you okay?" And I was like, "Yeah, man, I'm awesome. I got it out of my system. I feel great." So he nods, because he got the answer he was looking for. I'm clean or whatever. So I go to another meeting. It's the same kind of thing. And this guy says to me, "So are you working the program?" And then it all comes together for me. I was like, what are you talking about? And he said, "Well, I understand you went to Australia for rehab." And I said, Are you kidding me? I'd never quit drinking. It's the only thing I'm good at.
But there was a knee injury that happened somewhere along the way that basically kept you from continuing this.
Yeah, well, that was earlier on when I was in college. Okay. I hurt my knee, and I kind of got bounced out of the Tulane program because I hurt my knee on a motorcycle, and freshmen weren't allowed on motorcycles, so there wasn't a lot of love lost for a Yankee in New Orleans anyway. But north of the Mason-Dixon line, Yankee, not a obviously Yankee fan.
Sure, yeah.
But I kind of was washed out of that program, and I went back home to New York, and I thought, and my dad was a guidance counselor in high school, and he was like, you got to be in college. So my sister was at NYU, and I went to visit her, and I thought, well, this would be a cool place to go to college. They didn't have any baseball, and my knee was still twice the normal size. I was rehabbing it, trying to get it better. And I thought, well, I'll go to school here, and what would be easy? I had done a play in high school. That'd probably be easy. There'd be a lot of pretty girls. I'll just do that. So I literally gave it that much thought. I auditioned. They put me in. I actually auditioned with a monologue that I carved out of the book Catcher in the Rye, because Holden Caulfield's big brother's name is DB.
Oh.
And he went to Hollywood and became an asshole in the book. He's a screenwriter. So that's, you know, sort of like where I got that idea to do that monologue, because I love that book. And kind of ties into Field of Dreams, too, because that was the inspiration for that, was Salinger. And they took me and put me in the program. And I couldn't get any parts in the plays that they were doing at NYU. So I just started doing plays with my friends. Like, we found this empty room at NYU. And I just said to the dean, I said, can we use this room? Nobody's using it. And we started doing plays. And nobody knew how to be a director or do lights or anything. So we all just kind of figured it out. And by the third year of doing that, I had started inviting agents and casting directors and stuff, and one came, and I got an agent out of it. So, it kind of worked out.
There you go. And you had a couple of TV and movie roles, but I think the first role that everybody kind of knew who you were was Eight Men Out. What was the baseball activity and the training like for that? I mean, you mentioned how you obviously were naturally a good player and had played a little bit, but as all of you guys are getting ready to play, what was the athletic aspect of it like?
It was really fun. We got there 2 weeks early to Indianapolis, where we filmed it, because the Comiskey Park was not available. The old Comiskey was not available to us, because at that time the contract, maybe it's still the contract with Major League Baseball, is you can't contract, even if you're 35 games out in August, which the White Sox were. Yeah. They couldn't make a deal to film a movie at Comiskey in October, because they have to keep it open in case they make the World Series.
Okay.
So we ended up in Indianapolis. At that time, it was a AAA stadium for the, I think it was Indianapolis Indians. Now it's a sprint car racing track or something. But so we ended up filming there. And we got there 2 weeks early, and our baseball advisor was Ken Berry, who was the tremendous outfielder, defensive outfielder, especially for the California Angels and the Royals. And I can't remember who else he played for. But he was a great guy, and he helped us get ready. And it was fun watching him, because it was all levels of baseball experience. Like I had played, Charlie Sheen had played, and David Strathairn and Bill Irwin had not played at all. And so they were sort of approaching it more like choreography. And Bill Irwin is like the great Broadway clown, tremendous talent. He had never played any ball sports at all. And so he had to do one play in the movie where he's playing Eddie Collins, the second baseman. He's got to turn a double play. And so they showed him the footwork, like choreography, and step and turn, and he learned it as choreography. And then they threw the ball, and the ball had to basically hit his glove, because he had no, hand eye to catch a ball. And so they kept doing these takes where he would do the perfect footwork and put his hand in the right position, and if the guy threw the ball right there, and then finally it worked, and that's in the movie. So it was interesting to watch them piece together non-baseball players looking like baseball players.
And listen, you were a baseball fan, so you know some of the history, but I know that I read that you were doing research on Shoeless Joe, one of the things that stood out to you about him was that he wasn't as dumb as he was portrayed in the movie. What did you take from what you got to learn about Shoeless Joe versus what the general public perception is about him?
Well, I think Shoeless Joe is a much more complicated character than we were able to do in the movie. And I get it. It was an ensemble movie. And John Sayles had a certain take on the movie where it was sort of like class warfare. But the reality was the baseball players were very well paid. The whole myth of Charlie Comiskey being this evil owner is just not true. He was a former player. And, you know, some of the White Sox were among the most highly paid players in the league. And it was tough times in the country, and there were a lot of people out of work. And so they weren't like these abused, underpaid players. So, like Eddie Seacott, the pitcher that David Strathairn played, I think he was making $6,000 a year, which, that's like $6 million a year right now. It's not like he was being robbed. And I don't know if that's the right conversion, but something like that. And the other thing I found about Shoeless Joe is that he wasn't really that dumb. He was more like, I remember when there was an All-Star game in the 70s where Pete Rose showed up, and he had like a big fur coat on. And it was obviously a very expensive fur coat, but it was such a wrong fur coat to be wearing to a baseball stadium. And that was sort of like what I thought about Shoeless Joe, that he finally, yes, he was a naive rube at one point, but even playing the league for about 8 years, he was considered the best hitter in baseball. Everybody respected him. And now he just wanted to be left alone. So that was my view of him. But in the movie, it was important to John that he seemed dumber than that.
You mentioned how you learned to hit lefty for it, and that's one of the things that stands out about being authentic, because compared to, one of the critiques of Field of Dreams is that Ray Liotta batted right-handed, and baseball nerds like me like to point that out. Obviously both wonderful films, but every time somebody makes a list of the best baseball movies, Eight Men Out is kind of near the top because of the story of it. And as a guy who appreciates the athleticism and the movie making of it, what do you think about that?
Well, Field of Dreams is a tremendous movie, and it's one of the obviously I told you about going to Australia in the middle of my hottest period of my career. I also made a terrible mistake with Field of Dreams. They asked me to do that movie to play Shoeless Joe Jackson, and that would have been my fourth movie. And I was terrified that I would be typecast as a guy who was a former baseball player who could only play baseball players. So I talked them out of it. I turned it down. And I think Ray Liotta did a great job. I think people are too hard on him for the righty-lefty thing, because I've been on movies where they bring in at the last minute. You don't have a chance to prepare. And, you just do the best you can. And I had the luxury on Eight Men Out of, I had 6 month lead time. So you don't usually get that.
Yeah. And as far as like best baseball movies, you talked about Bull Durham, which had not come out yet. I mean, Eight Men Out is always the top of that list. Where do you kind of think that falls, and what are some of the other baseball movies that you enjoy besides the ones we talked about?
Well, I really like The Rookie. I thought The Rookie was great. I think Bang the Drum Slowly is maybe the most overrated baseball movie. I think the baseball is as bad as it gets in that movie. I think that Pride of the Yankees is a little overrated. I mean, it's fun to watch Babe Ruth, but, Gary Cooper is not athletic at all, and baseball feels kind of corny in a way. So I understand it's a product of its time, and it does have that emotional punch that takes it over the top, but the baseball aspect of it is not very good. Fear Strikes Out is an underrated movie. Jimmy Pearsall, the Anthony Perkins movie, and I'm trying to think of what the other ones. I think The Love of the Game is good. I mean, Costner, I think, is good anytime he plays a baseball player because, he's a very good baseball player. So he understands the world.
What's funny about For Love of the Game is that, you're right. It's a decent movie. It's an okay movie. It's not a great movie. But every time it's on, I treat it like it's a perfect game because I don't want to turn it off. I catch it in the middle and I'm like, okay, well, here he is. Billy Chappell's throwing a perfect game. I got to see if he completes it.
Yeah, I think it's really skillfully done, and anytime Costner's in a movie, I think he's got a strong hand in the storytelling beyond just playing the role, whether he's the director or not. He's got a very steadying influence, and I think he's a very underrated actor.
So you have another sports movie that is kind of in the pantheon. It always comes out. The Cutting Edge from 1992, hockey movie, figure skating movie. I think you could say it's a little bit of both. Is it fair to say that that's the role that people recognize you for the most even these days?
100%. I mean, I think I've been in like 80 or 90 movies, and I think I could do 80 or 90 more. It's still going to say Topic on my gravestone because it's just ingrained in people, and I'm glad because I'm really proud of that movie. And Tony Gilroy wrote this great script, and Moira Kelly was so good in the movie, and it was just one of those things where everything came together. And Roy Dotrice, the guy who played my coach, is just a great actor, and Paul Michael Glazer, who directed it, was at the top of his game, and so I'm real proud of it. For a long time, I was a little disappointed that I made a hockey movie that was not Slapshot. It was sort of like a figure skating movie. But then I've come to realize it's just that you can't compete apples and oranges.
I also noticed, I watched it last week, and it's, you know, truth be told, it's probably the first time I watched it start to finish. I usually catch it somewhere in the middle and, you know, over the last 20-something years. Dwyer Brown, who was in Field of Dreams, is a co-star in this.
Yeah, Dwyer is a great guy, and I actually ran into him. He's obviously, he plays Kevin Costner's dad in Field of Dreams, and I ran into him at Wrigley Field. He goes around, he has almost like a secular baseball ministry that he goes around and he tries to, you know, he connects with people over baseball. It's really, it's kind of cool, but he's a great guy. And I thought he was terrific in The Cutting Edge.
Yeah. And, you know, it holds up. So I guess, and do you find that it's more female driven because of the figure skating, or are there a lot of guys that come up and talk to you about it too?
Well, I think it's like a chick movie that guys can sit through. You know, that's, I think that's all you can hope for. You know, I mean, I can't, there's a lot of chick movies. We go down the list that I, you know, I get 20 minutes in and I'm rolling my eyes. So I take pride in that. I can get the guys to stick through the end. And, you know, I'll tell you, for the New York hockey fans, one great thing happened out of The Cutting Edge. When I first started skating, it was another situation. I didn't know how to skate. And so they gave me 3 months to learn. And Ron Gresham was a good friend of mine, still a good friend of mine. He was just retired from the Rangers. Mm-hmm. And he said, they gave me these 3 months to learn to skate. He said, I'll be your coach. Come on. You don't have to pay me. Let's go. And so he took me to the rink a few times, and I had other coaches as well. But he put me on the Rangers at that time. They still called it the old timers team, not the alumni. So I got to meet, you know, Rod Gilbert and Pete Stemkowski and Pierre LaRouche and all these great Rangers that I'd grown up watching. I was a Rangers fan, by the way, not Islanders. And, so after I'm skating for like 6 weeks, Gresham said to me one night in the bar where we did most of our serious work, he said, you're going to play in the game against the Islanders, old timers game in Long Beach, like at the Islanders practice rink or wherever. Oh, I don't know exactly what the building was. Pretty big barn. I'm skating for 6 weeks. They give me a jersey. I got a cage on. I don't even know how a hockey warm up goes. I've never been early enough to the game to see the warm up. So I'm in the middle of the warm-up with all these former NHL guys, and they didn't tell the Islanders that this was going on. So, and at that time, there's still obviously, to this day, there's a lot of bad blood. But back then in the 90s, I mean, there was a lot of bad blood.
Yeah.
So I'm in the warm-up. I go up against the glass, and I'm trying to figure out where to go. I remember they gave me number 42, and I was like, all right, I'm 42. And I'm standing by the window, and these two guys have a program behind me, Islander fans, I think, and they go, who the heck is 42? And I hear the other guy go, I don't know, but he must have had a lot of injuries.
So look, that
I'm trying
good,
to finish the warm up, trying not to fall down, and I get on the bench. I'm sitting next to Pierre LaRouche. I said, "What do I do?" And he says, "You just go to the net and keep your stick on the ice." So I was like, "Okay, go to the net." He must say, "All right." So I go in on the second shift. I'm on the ice. Pierre shoots it off my stick, and it goes into the net. I score. I couldn't believe it. I was like, "I just got a goal!" And it wasn't one of these 9-8 games. It was like 5-3 or something. Later in the game, I got another goal the same way, and Pierre did the same thing. I get in the locker room later, everybody's high-fiving Pierre and giving him $50. He had bet the whole team that he could score the most goals off my stick.
Really?
So I thought I was the hero.
Ah, that's great. The assist is worth more than the goal there, huh? That's great.
Totally.
That's great. Hey, you've had a number of other projects that revolve around sports, and one of the ones that I have not seen but I thought was kind of interesting, your directorial debut, Two Tickets to Paradise. Am I correct that this revolves around a guy's trip to the college football national championship game?
Yeah, it's a story. I wanted to do a movie about, you know, I wrote it with Brian Curry, who wrote the movie Green Book, and he's a good friend of mine, and we wanted to write a movie. I guess the inspiration, without getting too high and mighty about it, was he's from Boston, I'm from New York, and you know, 9/11 happened, and we were sort of thinking, my God, who, you know, there's no movies coming out of Hollywood that, like, if I was a first responder or somebody, I wanted to go home and just get my mind off all this stuff, that I would go watch. So that was literally the first thought of it. We started writing a movie about, okay, let's go to small town Pennsylvania, let's try and figure out. So we wrote this movie, and it took several years to get it made, and so finally, when we did get it made, you know, it was a great, great experience. And it's been fun having people come over the years, say, I saw that movie and I loved it. And, you know, Brian's one of the funniest guys you'll ever meet. So we're really proud of the dialogue in the movie.
And you got another one that, it should be in like the wheelhouse for me, but I somehow escaped it. You got co-stars Michael Warren, Bo Kimble, and Hakeem Olajuwon in a movie called Heaven is a Playground. What can you tell us about that?
Heaven is a Playground is actually, it's based on a great book by Rick Tallender, who's a sports writer for the Chicago Sun-Times. Mm-hmm. And it's a story that, it's a true, his own memoir about his experience as a young guy in New York. And he just got out of college. He had played football at Northwestern and actually was drafted by the Chiefs and had a year there. And, you know, he was, his athletic career was coming to an end. He's trying to figure out what to do. So he went to and organized like some guys that didn't have a basketball team and sort of made a team and, kind of like a low rent Harlem Globetrotters, and they'd run around New York and play these games. So he wrote this memoir about it, and then it got turned into a movie. And this is, I guess, about 25 years ago. And so they set the movie in Chicago. I'm not sure why they made that change, but I think it was because they thought they could get a young Michael Jordan to play the part that Bo Kimble ended up playing. And he was talking about it, and he was signed up for a while. And then I guess it was right as he was going from Michael Jordan with like a small M and a small J to Michael Jordan with like a capital M and a capital J. Yeah. And his agents, I think, talked him out of it. And so we ended up, you know, Bo Kimble's a great guy, and we ended up having a fun time with the movie. And Richard Jordan, the late great actor, was in it. And it was just, it was a fun experience, but it's not much of a movie, really. The best part about the movie was watching, you know, Hakeem Olajuwon. He came for like 2 days. And, you know, he was one of the freak athletes of all time. Like, I don't think he played basketball until he was a junior in high school. He was a soccer goalie.
Mm-hmm.
And just the athleticism that guy had was unbelievable. So, you know, I would chalk that one up to, it was a fun experience. I got to be friends with Rick Tallender, the writer, and, he's still my friend to this day. And, but the movie itself is, it's a bit of a miss.
You actually did get to be in a movie with Michael Jordan. I don't think anybody knew at the time that Michael B. Jordan would become the star he's become. He was one of the kids in Hardball.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember him like as a little kid. I mean, not, because a lot of child actors are, you know, a pain in the ass, and most of them flame out. But he, something about that kid, you could tell he was, you know, he had something going on. And I've just been really, I've not run into him since he's become such a big success with the Rocky reboot and everything, and Black Panther. And but he's doing a great job, and I'm rooting for him. I'm in his corner.
Yeah, Hardball is a movie with Keanu Reeves and Diane Lane. You really seem to be attracted to this. I'm looking up your stuff, and you've got a wrestling movie called Going to the Mat. You've got Underdogs, which co-stars one of your childhood heroes, Joe Namath. I mean, you've got a big sports connection with a lot of your Hollywood work.
Yeah, you know, that Joe Namath thing was great because my first job in the business was on Broadway in a show called The Kane Mutiny Court Martial. And I came in at the end of the run, like the last 6 weeks. When Broadway shows announce they're closing, a lot of the cast members, they'll leave the show to go to a new show that has a chance to run longer.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's at the beginning of its growth period. And so I got a chance to be in that play. It was the first thing I ever had. And 2 weeks after I joined, another guy jumped out of the cast, and Joe Namath came in to replace him.
Wow.
I think he replaced Michael Moriarty. Michael Moriarty was playing a different role, and then Joe came in and replaced somebody else. So anyway, so I got to know Joe Namath really well at that time, and it was pretty exciting doing a play. And he would hang out after the show. Like, actors are famous for like getting their makeup off and get the costume off, getting the heck out of the theater.
Yeah.
But athletes are more like, let's hang around, you know. So I'd sit in Joe's, you know, I had the little cramped closet upstairs shared with three guys' dressing room, and he had the star dressing room downstairs. So I'd go down and I'd have a drink with Joe Namath in his locker room, and it was. Then we'd go outside. It'd be like 11:30 at night. Step out onto the street in the middle of Broadway, and I'd be like, "Man, I'm in show business. I'm standing here with Joe Namath."
With Broadway Joe. There you go, right?
Yeah, it was unbelievable. So then years later, with Underdogs, a friend of mine, Doug Dirth, directed that. He asked me to come in and do that, and I did, and they got Joe, and it was an Ohio shoot, and they brought Joe in to play. Like, you know, he's a friend of somebody's friend. He comes in and gives the inspirational speech to my team. And, you know, it was really fun to see Joe again.
So you've got a project that's coming out now, and you sent me the preview of it. Now, it's about a 4 or 5 minute clip. Set this up for me as far as what this is going to become. It's called Two Dumb Mix. It's basically Doug Dorsey and Rudy all grown up.
The genesis of this thing is, again, like the same way with Two Things Paris, it's like trying to think of an audience that, you know, is underserved. So I just thought comedy right now, I started writing it, but it's comedy's gotten tricky because, you know, everybody gets offended by everything. So I was trying to think of what you can do that you're allowed to do. And I thought, well, a pie in the face is pretty universal, and who can get offended by that as long as it's equal? The groups get hit with pies in the face, everybody should be happy. So I thought I want to do like a slapstick, old school, you know, Laurel and Hardy type you know, comedy thing. And so I thought about all the people I'd worked with who I want to work with again. And Sean Austin and I did Memphis Belle back in 1990, and I bumped into him every 5 or 6 years. And he's one of the greatest guys in Hollywood, just such a nice guy. He also brings that thing, like, I think he made the Lord of the Rings, because that whole thing is a little bit silly, but he's got so much heart that you just stay there and you hang in with it. And it's, you know, and obviously it pays off if you stay through the whole three movies. Mm-hmm. But I think it's because of him. So I wanted to work with him again. So I wrote this part and I asked him to do it. And so we shot this thing. It's about these two idiots that meet in a drunk tank. And one guy has an idea of how they could pay off the best DUI lawyer. It's not a good idea. So, but they act on the idea. And that's the short version of it. And then it sets up subsequent episodes, which I've written 10 more episodes, and we're going to try and produce those this summer. We were going to save this first episode to just be the first of 10 that all play together, but I just thought, you know, with this quarantine now, everybody needs a laugh, so I just thought we'll unleash it right now.
And it's coming out April 1st?
April 1st on Facebook Live at 7 Eastern, and after that it'll be on Facebook and YouTube. People can watch it, and hopefully if you like it, you leave a comment, respond, tell your friends, because you know, whether or not we make 9 more or 5 more or no more is going to be based on how many people want it.
And you and Sean do some sort of Q&A with us, right?
Yeah, we're going to have a Q&A right after it's over. We're going to talk, answer questions, and anybody that wants to share it with their friends, and we'll probably do another one of these in a couple weeks where we'll have an interactive event where people can engage with us as well.
I love it. You're right. It's good for a laugh. A time when people need something to laugh at, this is just good, old-fashioned, silly humor. And it's funny that you mentioned like people getting offended by everything. The first glance of the title, Two Dumb Micks, you're like scratching your head a little bit. It's just two guys named Mickey.
Yeah. And I mean, it's definitely a play on, you know, I'm an Irish-American guy. Yeah. I grew up with a bunch of guys. And, you know, we used to call each other that. Not meanly, you know. I mean, I have friends. My sister lives in Ireland, and if you really want to piss off an actual Irishman, you call him a Paddy.
Okay.
So the Mick thing is kind of an American thing, and you know, I don't know. It was sort of a little. I could have softened the title, but I wanted to keep it. We're making fun of ourselves, so please play along with us.
Yeah, listen, it's all in good fun, and are all of them the same, like 4 or 5 minute variety?
They're probably going to end up being a little bit longer, 7 or 8 minutes, because that, you know, I'm being educated by the people in this world of short content. That's the sweet spot is 7, 8, 9 minutes. So they're probably going to get a little longer, which is going to be easier for me because I cut a bunch of stuff out of this that I thought was funny because I was shooting for 5 minutes. I thought that was the sweet spot when we made it, but I was wrong. So they're going to get a little longer, and we got some incredible guest stars that are lined up, and it's going to be, I think it's really going to be a fun thing.
That's great. And again, Facebook Live on April 1st, 7 o'clock Eastern.
April 1st, 7 o'clock Eastern. Yeah, and it is not an April Fool's joke. That's actually going to be the broadcast premiere.
All right, so what's a dream project for you from the sports world? What's something that, whether it's something you still want to act in, whether it's something you want to direct, is there something you've kind of been holding on to all these years as a sports project to say, man, I would love to get this done?
You know, it's in the world of racing, actually, car racing. And I grew up, you know, kind of watching. I grew up in Shoreham on Long Island. And in Riverhead, there was a thing called the Riverhead Raceway. And I used to go out there, and it was a drag track. And you'd see, like, the quarter-mile, you know, cars. And so I've always kind of been a little bit of a motorhead and interested in cars. And I just feel like there's something. Days of Thunder was a great movie. I wasn't much for Talladega Nights. I didn't think it was as funny as I thought it was. And I just feel like that there's still a great movie to be made in the world of NASCAR. And you know, just an escapist kind of movie. Probably got to be a guy who's got the odds against him, or a girl who's, you know, trying to come up through the ranks. And I don't know, I just think that world's kind of cool. I went to one race out in California of the, you know, real NASCAR stuff. I can't remember the town outside of Los Angeles where they have it, but it was incredible. I mean, it's such a spectacle, and people are listening on the headphones to all the different communications between the cars, and I think it's a cool world, and maybe it can't be today. Maybe it has to be 30 years ago. I don't know. Sports movies, I think, often work better when they're not present day, because then you can sort of turn off your, okay, this is not reality. You know, you can sort of say, okay, this is back once upon a time. So that's something I'd like to do. You know, I love the horse racing world as well. So those two areas of sports I think would be cool. I love football. I mean, but football is a tough one to make into a movie. just because it's so subtle, you know, the differences between, you know, whatever, some guy did an out route, he did it one step too quick. I don't know, how do you communicate that to the audience that, you know, that's why he failed. So, I think that racing and boxing, there's a reason that there's so many movies about those, because you know who won. The guy's laying down lost. The guy, you know, came in second at the checkered flag. It's a little easier storytelling wise.
It's funny you mentioned that, though, about, you know, the setting of it, because I recently had a chance to have a great conversation with Angelo Pizzo, who wrote Rudy and Hoosiers. And one of the things he talked about Hoosiers is it doesn't date because it's already dated. When you do a period piece, when you do something that's set in the past, it, you know, you don't see it age poorly over the course of, say, 5 or 10 years. And, you know, Hoosiers, we talked about, one of the great sports movies of all time. One of those reasons is you don't look at the basketball action and say, oh, look how it's dated. It's already set in a dated time.
Yeah, I think... For sure. I think that's a great way to say it. I'd leave it to a writer to say it better than me, but I think that's exactly right. And you know, it's funny, you just mentioned Hoosiers again. That made me think of another movie, Miracle, and the thing that Miracle, yes, and Hoosiers have in common is that they have a bunch of quote-unquote unknown guys playing the players. And that was so smart, because now you're not trying to figure out, like, oh, okay, Keanu Reeves is the goalie, and now I got to pretend it's not the guy from The Matrix as the goalie. So I think that's another smart thing to do in sports movies, is to have people who are not recognizable from another role. I guess I'm arguing against myself here in a way, but I still think it's true. I mean, I remember the guys in Hoosiers who played, they were all pretty good basketball players, and the guys in Miracle, I think, could all skate. Like, they had sequences there that were unbelievable. So I think that might be one of the keys too, is that, you know, you don't ask, you know, somebody, a household face to play somebody that we already know from other media sources.
So are there, listen, you've had a really good career. Are there any regrets about not being Shoeless Joe in Field of Dreams also?
I mean, I would have loved to have done that. I think that would have been great. I mean, there's certainly some movies that I wish I had been in. But I read this book when I was in college. It was given to me by one of the acting teachers, and it was called Be Here Now. And it's like a 60s hippie book. It was mostly like drawings, and it was like all about taking acid. It was kind of I couldn't really wrap my head around the book, but the title of it always stuck with me as the best advice you could ever have as an actor is be here now. And I've always just tried to go by that ethos. And later on, when I studied the Sanford Meisner technique, that's kind of like what they're getting at. They're trying to train you to be here now. And I thought, well, I already know how to do that. I'm just going to be in the moment that I'm in. And so I never made my career my priority. I was always thinking, wow, what has being here where I am right now, what opportunity do I have? And, you know, I was at Game 7 when the Rangers won the Stanley Cup. I've been to so many great sporting events. I've been to the Kentucky Derby. I've been to the Indy 500. And I've been to great cultural events. I've been all over Europe. And so I've just lived my life. And I suppose if I had focused on my career as, like, my number one priority, maybe I'd have more dough, but I wouldn't have better experiences.
Well, there are only about 20,000 people who were at Game 7 when the Rangers won. That must have been a life-changing experience.
It was incredible. And the thing that I have a lot of great memories, but one of the greatest memories was going with the team to the auction house. This guy named John Baronis, who had this bar, great bar on the Upper East Side, and yeah, it was kind of where the Rangers hung out. And we went there after midnight, after this, you know, after this team meal and the whole thing, and went up, and it was just a team and maybe family, so maybe 75 people in this bar, and everybody's hanging out all night drinking out of the Stanley Cup. And so at dawn, we go outside, and there's like police barricades, there's horses, there's like 5,000 Ranger fans outside this bar waiting to get a glimpse of Messier with the cup. It was unbelievable. I'll never forget that.
I've been to that place, and I heard that story. I was probably there, I don't know, like maybe like a year or two after. I've heard that story that this is where the Rangers came with the cup after. And I don't know. Hey, it's one of the other successful things about sports movies is you take something that's happened a long time ago that's somewhat familiar, but you've got an entire generation that really doesn't know a whole lot about it. Maybe there's something in that project for you.
I'd be great, you know. I mean, I don't know. I guess I'd have to be. I got to be a coach at this point. I can't be a player right anymore. But I could be a couple more years. I can be the owner. Maybe.
But try to be Neil Smith.
That was an incredible moment, and I think cinematically there'd be something there, because, you know, we didn't have texting yet in '94, obviously. So actually, that was like one person calling, another person calling, another person calling, another person, and over a period of 3 or 4 hours, ending up to 5,000 people. That's just like an amazing, you know, moment to have that. You could, you know, show that moment in the movie of how this crowd assembled, like just like a kind of a flash mob, old school analog flash mob.
That's a really great point, because nowadays somebody would just take a quick video and post it, and all of a sudden we would be watching Mark Messier and the Stanley Cup at this bar in New York City.
Yeah, I think in a sad way for my kids and for, you know, going forward, it cheapens a lot of things, because, you know, the people that were in that bar obviously had a right, they all belong there, but it was like winning the lottery to be there in that moment and have that experience. It was not something that could be, you know, bought and sold. It wasn't something that could be communicated to other people who would just show up then. You know, it was like you had to be there.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Listen, I really enjoyed talking to you. I hope we get to do it again. Good luck with Two Dumb Mix on Facebook Live April 1st. And I'll tell people again how to get that in just a second. So thanks again for that, and good luck with it.
Thanks a lot, Sweetie. Take care of our name.
Absolutely. It's good to finally catch up with you.
You too. Take care.
My thanks to DB Sweeney. And once again, you can catch the premiere of Two Dumb Mix Tuesday, April 1st at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Facebook Live. I've seen a preview of the 5-minute pilot, which is what you'll see. And it's a really funny premise, gives you a few laughs. And isn't that something we all could use right now? Just some laughs. Check it out and be on the lookout for the follow-ups as well. If you're new here, please check out the archive of 30 with Murdy at radio.com, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen to podcasts. Some of my recent episodes include a conversation with Angelo Pizzo, the screenwriter of Hoosiers and Rudy. He's also written a Mickey Mantle script that he says is better than both of them, but still has not been made into a movie. And I also recently spoke to Bobby Richardson, the great Yankee second baseman from the 1950s and 60s, who shares some memories from those great championship teams. So please check those out. Subscribe, review, and all that jazz. And until next time, I'm Sweeney Murdy. Please stay home, stay safe, and thank you for listening.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.